Welcome to Romancing the Saints with Pastor Gene Pensiero. We're glad you're joining us as we study verse by verse through books of the Bible, discovering God's extravagant love for His people. Now we pick back up in Judges chapter 21 in verses 1 through 25 in the second part of a study titled, You May Now Catch the Bride.
But I maintain that these guys ought to have just nullified their vow. Even if they thought it would bring harm to them, it's more spiritual than to go out and kill more people. Their vow was equal to God's law, however, in their mind. Being legalists, that thought never entered their minds. And so they're going to actually make matters worse. Verse 6, children of Israel grieved for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them our daughters as wives? And they said, what one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord? And in fact, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were counted, indeed not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. No reason is given for the absence of men from Jabesh-Gilead. For all they knew, it could have been an oversight. Maybe, I mean, seriously, they didn't have texting in those days, no mass communication. Maybe they just didn't get the message or they didn't get it on time. But fueled by a legalistic spirit, the men of Israel were intent on keeping their rash vows above all else. And so verse 10, so the congregation sent out there 12,000 of their most valiant men, and commanded them, saying, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, including women and children. And this is the thing you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man intimately. And so, do you see how their legalism keeps making things worse? Instead of repenting of their initial vow, they think of another vow they made, more foolish and rash than the first. Not only did they commit further atrocities, they felt justified in doing them. We might describe them as keeping to the letter of the law while ignoring the spirit of the law. Even if the men of Jabesh-Gilead had outright refused to join in the war against the Benjamites, the appropriate punishment wasn't mass murder. Okay, you guys didn't come to help us, so we're going to murder you. And not only your fighting men, all of you. Well, not all of them. Because they're going to use the vow as an excuse to solve their bride problem. So they found, verse 12, among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Their vow, as recorded in verse 5, seemed to be confined to fighting men who refused to join them against the Benjamites. They altered it to include everyone except young virgins, whom they needed to resolve the problem created by their other vow. Legalists are always changing the rules to fit their situation. Sabbath keeping is a good example. We call people who try to observe the Sabbath, Sabbatarians. And each Sabbatarian has his or her own list of what constitutes work on the Sabbath. Their list always benefits them while projecting restraints on others. It's all subjective. It's all man-made. It is custom-tailored to benefit the person keeping it. When Gene had a paper route, we had a family, an Adventist family, Sabbatarians on 11th Avenue, whom you could not collect from on Saturday because they considered paying for the newspaper to their poor little paper boy who was trembling and weeping outside their door. They considered that work. I'll tell you what's work. It's having a paper route and having people not pay you. But anyway, so they one time, you know, the first time we tried to collect, they came to the door, and I remember Gino, he's 11 or 12 years old, come. I said, well, what happened? They go, they say they can't do any work on the Sabbath. Well, the dad was out there mowing his lawn. So that's not work, but paying for the Hanford Sentinel, that was work. So it's an extreme example, it's a silly example, but this is the way Sabbatarianism works. God said in the Old Testament, even if you wanted to keep the Sabbath, there's really no rules. Just it's a day of rest. And then the rabbis come along and say, oh, what does that mean? And they have all these crazy rules and regulations that always benefit themselves. And so custom tailored to benefit the person keeping it. It's legalism. Verse 13, then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon, and they announced peace to them. Problem solved. They murdered their fellow Israelites, including non-combatants, women, and children, in order to kidnap brides for the 600 Benjamites. People of Jabesh-Gilead found out the hard way that legalism is a powerful enemy. I said we are to look out for legalism's attack to abduct us. As believers who are saved by grace through faith and who continue to walk with Jesus by faith in the power of the Spirit, we're surrounded by legalism and legalists. We need to look out for them. In some cases, it can be a life and death matter. Christians are right now being forced to convert to Islam or to die. They have to make that choice. That's an extreme form of Islamic legalism. You're going to follow our laws or we're going to kill you. The assault upon us in the West is not physical so much as it is spiritual. There's a constant pressure on us to conform to a set of man-made rules, thinking these will help us to achieve or maintain our salvation. Now, the truth is, we are to keep God's law, but not by strict mechanical obedience. One pastor said, the legalist focus is only on obeying bare rules, destroying the broader context of God's love and redemption in which he gave his law in the first place. The way to defend against legalism's attack is to abduct you is to hold as foundational what Jesus said was the greatest commandment. So the legalist comes along and they say, here's some commands that you must keep in order to get saved or stay saved, and it makes you more spiritual. And so if you want to talk commandments, what was the greatest commandment? Well, Jesus said it was that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So if you are pursuing that kind of personal, passionate relationship with Jesus, you'll be immune from the onslaught of legalists and their various legalisms. You'll act in love, and you will find yourself keeping God's law as a byproduct. Maybe you're not a Christian here this morning. That's possible. I'm here to tell you that you don't become one by obeying man-made rules and rituals that are seemingly based on the Bible. There's nothing you can do to be saved in terms of your works. Your very best efforts will always fall short. You can't work your way to heaven. You can't get there by deeds. Jesus offers you salvation as a free gift of God's grace. What do you normally do when somebody gives you a gift? You receive it, you open it, you enjoy it. And that's why we say salvation is by grace through faith. You simply believe in Jesus. It's a gift that you must receive and accept. And once you do, you can be saved. And so don't think that you have to go out and figure out how to dress or what sacraments to keep or clean up your life or anything like that. The Lord takes you just the way you are, dressed in filthy rags, spiritually speaking. He takes those upon himself on the cross and he offers you what he calls a robe of righteousness that equips you for heaven. Salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, plus nothing. Now, this is serious because in the New Testament we see the Apostle Paul oftentimes hounded by legalists. He would come into a city, preach the gospel in a synagogue, get kicked out of the synagogue, preach the gospel to Gentiles. Gentiles would get saved, genuinely saved, born again, filled with the Spirit, establish a church. Paul would leave. Following him would be these guys called Judaizers. And they would say, hey, you guys are off to a great start. You're almost saved. Paul didn't tell you that you also need to be circumcised like Jews and you need to keep certain dietary regulations like Jews and keep certain feast days like the Jews. Then you'll be really saved. And we have our version of this in Christian circles as well. And so, but none of those things save you. If someone tells you that you can be saved in any other way than by faith in Jesus Christ, that's legalism. And we should be excited about that because though it's not easy to believe, that's all that you need to do to have eternal life. Now, we need to look in for legalism's attack to abduct you as well. There's another form of legalism that attacks us, one we haven't yet mentioned. It is trying to find all sorts of creative ways to get around God's law. This isn't making our own law. It's actually looking at the Word of God and saying, I know what it's saying, but maybe there's a workaround. Maybe I don't have to obey that. The New Testament era Pharisees were excellent practitioners of this. Once they thought they could get away from honoring their elderly parents by taking the support they should offer them and dedicating it to God instead. And so under the law, you were obligated to take care of your parents as they got older. I remind Gene of this every day. The Pharisees knew this was true, but they said, but if we take the money that we were going to help our parents with and dedicate it to God, that's our God account, well, then that trumps our need to spend it on our parents, and then we'll just hang on to it in our God account until they die, and then we'll think, oh, well, they're dead now, and so that money reverts to us. And so this was a workaround, a loophole, they thought. I'd throw out as a modern example the many creative arguments believers use to justify getting involved romantically with non-believers and subsequently marrying them. Young ladies especially seem to fall for this all the time. Is your boyfriend, is your fiancé a Christian? No, but he knows the Bible better than most Christians. Wow. Okay. And he's going to go to hell and recite it? I don't understand what that means. No, but he's a lot better person than most of the Christian men I know who, you know, treated me like, you know, terribly, but he treats me nice. Okay. So what does that have to do with the price of tea in China? You know, I mean, and so there's these workarounds that we kind of convince ourselves that I know that I'm not supposed to be unequally yoked together with a non-believer, but I can't find any believer that treats me right who knows as much about the Bible as this non-believer I'm not supposed to marry, so I'm good. And it sounds funny, but it becomes tragic later on when people find out that it's not a good idea to be unequally yoked together with non-believers. When I say to look in for legalism, I mean to emphasize that we are prone to it by nature. It's not just all assaulting us from without. Our very nature is drawn to legalism so that we can kind of relax. Sometimes if I had 10 things that I could do and know that I was completely right with God, I just, oh man, I'd sigh in relief and think I'm coasting now on my way to heaven because I've got all those things checked off. As our story continues, we'll see an example of this kind of legalism. If you were paying attention and you're really smart and did the math, you realize that they were still 200 brides short to supply 600 Benjamites. I got that from 600 minus 400 equals 200. It's high-level math for me. So here comes their legalistic solution, verse 14. So Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. And yet they had not found enough for them. And the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. All right, we have to stop and talk about that last sentence, even though I don't want to because it's off subject, but it's important. The writer, who we believe was Samuel, seems to blame the Lord by saying it was the Lord who made this void. The ISV translates these words, the Lord had broken Benjamin. Samuel, who's the author here, might have simply meant that it was a bummer that Benjamin had needed to be punished at all. So think of it this way. If you're a parent, do you like disciplining your kids? I mean, do you wake up in the morning and think, man, I can't wait to get to that first tantrum. I am so looking forward to disciplining my kids today instead of doing what needs to be done. Well, no, of course not. And then you like it even less when they refuse to yield and your discipline gets more severe. Have you ever had those days with your kids where 10 minutes worth of discipline turned into an entire day of just practically pulling out your hair because you knew you couldn't lose this battle? This was the key battle in the life of your child. And I'm not talking about any kind of child abuse or anything. I'm talking about just loving corrective discipline. Nobody likes that. So I think what Samuel is saying is that it was a bummer that Benjamin needed to be disciplined in the first place. Now the Israelites, for their part, they went on to discipline the Benjamites too much. They're like these crazy people you read about who say, well, the Bible told me to do that, or God told me to do that. No, the Bible didn't tell you to punch your kid in the face and make him bleed, or to starve him, or to tie him up to a chair, or to lock him in a closet. That's abuse. That's on you. And so that's the kind of situation here. God says, hey, these men need to be disciplined. It's a bummer that it has to happen. And then the Israelites come and say, oh, we'll do it, and we'll take it too far. And so that's, I think, what's being said here. Not that God was the orchestrator of all these events and was the one who wanted them to kill women and children. That's certainly not true. And so verse 16, then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed? In other words, we murdered them. And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin. Then they said, in fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Labona. Therefore they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, go lie in wait in the vineyards. Watch, and just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go to the land of Benjamin. In other words, kidnap them. Then it shall be when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time. You're not guilty of any oath. So in other words, we can't give our women to the Benjamites because we took an oath. But if we look the other way and they get kidnapped, technicality. I'm clean, my oath stands, and all we did was sexually assault some ladies and kidnap them for Benjamites. Too bad it's all completely immoral. How can kidnapping brides be okay? It can, to the legalist looking for a technicality. Remember I said at the beginning, legalism is really, really bad. It's far worse than you think, because it keeps snowballing into something greater and greater. Then President Bill Clinton famously said of Monica Lewinsky, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. For her part, in an interview with Barbara Walters, Ms. Lewinsky described her activities with the president as, quote, fooling around. Now, we found out to the dishonor of the Oval Office that they were, in fact, having what any Christian would consider sexual relations. They redefined the term and they used it as a technicality to argue that what they were doing wasn't sex. Their denials have become a loophole that even Christians use to this day to say that certain sexual behaviors aren't really sexual relations, so therefore it's okay for believers to engage in them prior to marriage. It was a problem when it happened, and it's still a problem today. The point is this: don't be looking for loopholes or workarounds. Don't redefine things that are clear in Scripture. That is a sinister, subversive form of legalism. Verse 23, and the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, from they caught. And then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. They all lived happily ever after. All of this trouble began when perverted men in Gibeah had sexually assaulted a Levite's concubine. Now it was ending with bride kidnapping, which is in fact a sexual assault. It is a sex crime. If you're in doubt about that, kidnapping a woman to marry her and forcing her to marry you is a sex crime. There's nothing exciting about it. This wasn't the annual catch a bride festival. And so they end up exactly where they start, only they're justified in their own mind for doing something at least as bad as what they started off hating. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. I'm guessing they felt pretty good about themselves. Everything seemed to have worked out just fine. Legalism is like that. It seems to work out externally on paper. But at what cost? In our story, the cost was immense. Tens of thousands were murdered. Hundreds were kidnapped. Those left alive were deceived into thinking they were right with their God, having kept their stupid oaths. They were therefore self-righteous, and no one goes to heaven by self-righteousness, meaning they too were their own casualties of legalism. They were so legalistic that they were going to go to hell. Think of all the loopholes that we find in the civil laws of our nation or in the tax codes. Do you feel bad if you find a loophole that saves you money? I'm guessing not. And you know what? I don't. Hey, it's the law. And if it's legal and it's not immoral, I don't have to lie about it. I don't want to pay. Do you want to pay more taxes? If you want to pay more taxes, I tell you where you can give some other money too. Nobody wants to pay more taxes. And so there are loopholes. Normally they, you know, they benefit the rich and all of this kind of thing. But it's legal. We try and stop them and all. Now, however, I am saying unequivocally that it is wrong to look for loopholes in your walk with the Lord. See, we have a natural tendency to try to get off on a technicality, to look for the loophole. What's the workaround? Here's what God says. I don't think I can do that, or I want to do that. So how? Maybe I can redefine the word. If this word means something else than its clear, obvious meaning in context, then I don't have to do what the Lord tells me to do. And this is the basis for a lot of liberal Christianity, even among, you know, evangelicals who just are not willing to submit to the word. I mentioned the greatest commandment earlier is our protection from legalism. We might summarize it by asking ourselves in every situation, what does God's love and loving God require of me? Verse 25, then in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The era of the kings would come, would start off badly with Saul, chosen by the people based on his external qualifications. It would continue with David, who was God's choice based on the heart. One day, the greater son of David, Jesus, will sit as king over the millennial earth and on into eternity. Let's take one last look at legalism. This chapter gives us two pictures that warn us that legalism is on the attack. First, we saw the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead living peacefully in the promised land. For whatever reason, they did not join with their brothers against Benjamin. They didn't make any foolish, rash vows. But legalism came and attacked them, and in their case, it destroyed them. Legalism will always attack you from without while you are at peace with the Lord, enjoying your relationship with Him. Legalists cannot stand your freedom in Jesus, and they want you to join them or be destroyed. So if I make some man-made rule, this makes me more spiritual or maintains my salvation, and you say, I'm a Christian, and I'm not obeying that, then there's a problem. There's a big divide. Somebody is wrong, and it's the legalist, and so they want to get you to conform somehow to what they believe rather than take a deeper look at their own vows. Second, the young ladies were on their way to rejoice when men assaulted them. The men were lying in wait within their own territory, as it were. Just so you and I have a bent lying within us to be taken captive by legalism, it will lead to self-righteousness and it will rob you of joy. These gals never got to the dance. They were robbed of their joy because of something that was in their midst. And so remember, it's not just coming from outside. It's not just weird people coming to you. You and I want to be legalists. It's something that's in our nature, and we need to fight it. It's possible that each of us has an area in our lives right now in which we're believing or behaving legalistically. Is there something you do or do not do that you believe makes you more spiritual than others? Do you ever look at somebody and maybe judge them because of their behavior and think, well, I'm a little bit more spiritual than that? It's usually something in a so-called gray area, not directly commanded or condemned by the Bible. And it's always fun to me to see some of these things like dress codes and the lengths to some people will go to try and prove that their dress code is actually in the Bible. Taking stuff out of context, making stuff up, ignoring certain things in order to do that. And so, you know, we have these things that we believe make us more spiritual. You might think your freedom to participate in something makes you more mature than others. You might think your avoidance of something makes you more mature than others. Either way, the truth is you're under attack by legalism. And if you believe either way makes you more spiritual, then you've already been taken captive. You've already given into it. And you just need to repent, spend time with the Lord, and break free by asking, what does God's love and loving God require of me? Do that, and you will fulfill the law.
Pastor Gene has been serving in the Central Valley of California at Calvary Hanford since 1985. You can find hundreds more Bible studies by visiting our website at calvaryhanford.com. There you'll find video, audio, and transcripts of sermons just like the one you just heard. You can also find links to get Pastor Gene's books at calvaryhanford.com/books. We hope you'll join us next time on Romancing the Saints as we continue to discover that you are the passion of Jesus.